This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
a Kenyan appeals court has ordered the release of doctors' union officials jailed earlier this week for refusing to end their three-month strike. Kenyan legal experts and rights groups will now take the lead in a fresh round of negotiations between doctors and the government to end the strike.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, the inflation rate in Nigeria is the highest it's been in 11 years. And drought is causing staple food prices in East Africa to rise sharply.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the inflation rate in Nigeria is the highest it's been in 11 years as prices for food, fuel, transportation, and electricity continue to rise. AFP reports the consumer price index rose to 18.72% in December, an increase of just under 0.2%. Food prices alone rose nearly 18%. Nigeria fell into recession last August due to very low world oil prices. At the same time, attacks on oil and gas facilities in the Niger Delta sharply reduced production. Inflation has not been this high in Nigeria since September 2005, when it reached more than 24%.
A Kenyan appeals court has ordered the release of doctors' union officials jailed earlier this week for refusing to end their three-month strike. Kenyan legal experts and rights groups will now take the lead in a fresh round of negotiations between doctors and the government to end the strike. Mohamed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi.
The seven doctors' union officials spent 2 days behind bars after being sentenced to 1 month in jail Monday. A three-judge bench ordered their release Wednesday after Kenya's Council of Governors and union lawyers agreed to continue talks.
Appellants number 1 to 8 in civil appeal number 9 of 2017 shall be released forthwith from prison pending the hearing of the appeal. 2, that the applicants, respondents and interested parties undertake to resume negotiations forthwith with a view to resolving the outstanding issues in order to restore normalcy in the public sector.
The court ordered the Law Society of Kenya and Kenya National Commission on Human Rights that will be leading the talks to submit a report next week with the aim of calling off the month-long doctor strike. After the ruling, the cry of striking doctors in the streets rings out. CBA. The collective bargaining agreement was signed in 2013 between the union and government representatives. The deal covers a range of issues, including improving working conditions for the doctors, improved health facilities, and security for medical staff. Several attempts to end the strike through dialogue have failed, with doctors refusing a 40% salary increase. In solidarity with their colleagues, doctors working in private hospitals have agreed not to serve patients for 2 days. The court hopes the union will call off the strike within 7 days. Policy analyst Boaz Munga says it is not easy to solve their grievances in 1 week.
But 7 days is surely enough for them to negotiate a return to work formula, which means they can go back to work after negotiating and then the other pending issues will be sorted out, but not ironing out all the issues contained in any collective bargaining agreement.
Munga also says as the country approaches an election, the doctors feel this may be the only chance for them to get what they want.
Many workers in our country have realized that perhaps the best time to try to twist the government, which doesn't seem to want to listen to you at other times, is when we are approaching an election.
A new round of talks is expected to begin Thursday. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Drought conditions in Kenya are forcing northern pastoralists to graze their animals illegally on private and communal lands, causing conflict with landowners. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Boasting spectacular wildlife and majestic scenery, Central Kenya's Laikipia area has long been on the country's tourist circuit, sitting against the backdrop of Mount Kenya. But due to drought, northern pastoralists are bringing tens of thousands of cattle to private and public lands in search of water and grazing land, often putting them into conflict with landowners and displacing wildlife. Several people have been killed in the conflicts, with others injured. Laikipia Farmers Association Chairman Martin Evans says all landowners have been affected in some way.
Every single one has had damage. When they come in, they smash your fences, they smash all your infrastructure, all your buildings, your security houses, solar panels, electric energizers, they steal and smash. I haven't heard of one that hasn't been.
Kenya's spokesperson for the Ministry of Interior, Mwende Njoka, blames it on one factor.
A drought that has, the dry spell that has been in that area for a long time, and in many other parts of the country. That is what has caused these people to move their cattle to areas where there's grass and water.
But Wildlife Direct CEO Paula Kahumbu says that is not an excuse.
This drought was known about more than 6 months ago. These incidents started more than 6 months ago. There was ample opportunity for the state and state organs to respond, and they didn't. These cattle should have been bought up, and the people had their money put away somewhere safe well before the drought reached this point.
Njoka argues that it is a complex socioeconomic issue.
We've been doing a lot, and we've sent security forces there. Police officers were deployed in the area from different units to go and protect these farms and ensure that they're not invaded. Although sometimes it has not been as successful as we would have wanted, but there's a lot the government is doing on that.
Kahumbu says the pastoralists are highly adapted to extremely dry conditions.
So for them to have resorted to raiding private land and community land, it is a really a reflection of how serious the drought is. It's a famine for them. So let's not forget that these are people who are in dire straits, and the government of Kenya has failed them too, which is why they're doing what they're doing.
But conservationists cannot fully explain why wildlife have been killed, including at least 9 elephant deaths, as well as other endangered species like giraffes and the Grevy zebra. Frank Pope is the CEO of Save the Elephants.
The wildlife is the lowest on the chain when it comes to competing with livestock, because the livestock are accompanied by humans, and these humans have arms often.
The Laikipia Farmers Association wants the government to begin a disarmament program, prosecute the people involved, and enforce the law. Some conservation groups suggest the government buy up livestock to assist the pastoralists, as well as bring harvested grass from other parts of the country to Laikipia to help feed the animals. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Staple food prices in East Africa are rising sharply as drought withers crops before they can be harvested. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says both households and pastoralists are suffering. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The FAO reports record high prices for maize, sorghum, and other cereals in many parts of Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, Uganda, and Tanzania. FAO senior economist Mario Zappacosta is coordinator of the Global Information and Early Warning System.
The main reasons behind the current crisis, which has a regional characteristic affecting most of the countries in Eastern Africa, is the drought that affected the southern part of the region between October and December. But in some countries, the crisis is even compounded by other factors, such as conflict and violence in South Sudan and Somalia.
He warns that sharply increasing food prices have alarming consequences in terms of food security.
Prices went almost double in the last 12 months in most of the markets, prices of cereals. So most of the households that do not produce their own food, they have to access markets and prices are very high. So their purchasing power is at lowest level.
Food security in the region was already much weaker following last year's El Nino weather event. The FAO says poor and erratic rainfall greatly reduced harvests. As for pastoralists, they've seen prices for livestock fall to one-third of what they were a year ago. Zappacosta says that means they have little money to buy cereals.
To give you an example with numbers, a year ago in some parts of Somalia, a pastoralist selling a goat was receiving the equivalent to buy almost 110, 120 kilos of maize. Now, for the same goat, he can buy only 30 kilos of maize. So obviously, his capacity to feed his family is curtailed by 70, 80%.
The situation may not get better anytime soon. The FAO senior economist says this is the dry season in East Africa, and no rains are expected until the end of March or early April. So harvests in July and August may once again be well below normal. Zappacosta says parts of some countries are especially vulnerable.
In some countries, we know that there is a risk of famine, namely in Somalia and South Sudan, where the drought is compounded by the problems related to conflict and insecurity.
In addition to record-high cereal prices, beans now cost 40% more in Kenya than a year ago. And in Uganda's capital, Kampala, beans and cassava flour are 25% higher. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In Mauritania, a new project by the International Funds for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, aims to get food from over 250,000 farmers into local markets. Among the products are mint, used nationwide for tea, as well as vegetables, goat milk, and gum arabic. The project will also introduce solar-run freezers to store chickens for sale in markets in the capital. Philippe Remy is the country manager for IFAD in charge of Mauritania. Reporter William Eagle talked with him about the $45 million project.
The project will support value chains. And the objective of the project is to help farmers to be involved in the value chain. Because often, small farmers are a bit left out. They are marginalized in the value chain. So the idea is to involve them in the activities, to develop their capacity, of course, to produce, but also to develop their capacities to enter into, to develop contracts, relationships with the other actors, or the other part of the value chain. We will help farmers to develop contracts, for example, with the buyers, with the processors, with transporters who can transport the food and the produce to Nouakchott.
A part of the project focuses on horticulture. Are you thinking of indigenous foods, Philippe, or even forgotten foods that might survive in a dry climate, a region that is threatened by climate change?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, Mauritania is really hit by climate change. So we have actually a component on climate change adaptation in the project. And yes, horticulture, for example, there will be indigenous plants that will be supported, particularly, I don't know the English term for them, osei and this type of food. But also, for example, mint, which is very, very important, for example, people, they produce mint in their gardens because this is used for the tea. You know, they put mint in their tea. So it's there is a big market on that. Of course, not to focus only on one type of production, but to diversify and to adapt to the demand of the market. If there is a big demand in terms of mint, actually, farmers will develop a contract with some buyers and we will support that at this level. So this is the idea. And the component on climate change is it's about 6 million. And the idea is really to develop drip irrigation, to develop this type of techniques, saving water, using water better, more efficiently, and to use also solar energy.
The press release mentioned non-timber forest products.
Non-timber, exactly. Arabic gum. For example, this is the main product actually, because there are a lot of Arabic gum trees, and the market is really turned to exports. So there are some buyers in Nouakchott, and they come to the villages and they look for gum. The problem is there is a lack of quality in the gum and a lack of productivity of the trees. So actually, on this value chain, the idea is really to improve that, the quality of the trees, the management of the trees, the collect of the produce to make it more efficient, and then to develop contracts with the buyers who are mostly in Nouakchott, but they are represented also in the region.
Farmers will also raise chickens for meat and goats for milk. Is there enough food for the animals in the region, like cereals, to feed them?
In the project, the idea is to support farmers and then also to support the development of feed around the farms. So, but it's not cereals. It will be actually grass. The women, they have gardens. So in the gardens, they can produce horticulture, they can produce legumes, and so on. They can produce tomatoes and so on. But the ground, the land is not used all the time. So it's possible to have a part of it where they can grow some grass, which is a high-level nutrient grass for animals. So they can do that in part of the time in their garden. So this is one way of doing it.
That was Philippe Remy of the International Fund for Agricultural Development in Mauritania. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
The Sinai has been the scene of ongoing terrorist attacks targeting members of the Egyptian army and police. They began after the army removed the elected Muslim Brotherhood president, Mohamed Morsi, in 2013. Despite government anti-terrorist efforts, the insurgency continues. Some local tribes recently protested military action. Professor David DeRoche is with the Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. He explains to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi the reasons behind the insurgency and the need for a different strategy to deal with it.
There seems to be a significant civil military problem in the Sinai Peninsula. Unfortunately, the people who live there tend to regard the Egyptian government as a foreign occupying force. And relations have gotten so bad that, you know, you are in an almost insurgency situation. It really is a difficult and dangerous situation for the Egyptian government.
The Sinai tribes are starting a civil disobedience move to protest the harsh reactions and the poor economic situation. What do you make of that?
Unfortunately, this is likely to be indicative of a counterproductive Egyptian security forces action. You know, there is violence perpetrated against the Ministry of the Interior forces and the army in Egypt, and the people who are doing it are hiding among the population. But if you crack down on the entire population, what you wind up doing is alienating them, driving them away from the government towards the other side. The Bedouin in the Sinai never fully benefited from membership of the Egyptian state, and unfortunately, the crackdown seems to be indiscriminate and obviously has led them to signal their displeasure with the Egyptian government. It's unfortunate, but I don't think it necessarily means that they will ally with the Ansar al-Maqdis. I don't think that'll happen.
If what's going on in Sinai is a guerrilla warfare by some highly trained terrorists, how do you assess the counter efforts using fixed checkpoints or random airstrikes?
Random airstrikes are never a good idea. Airstrikes should be targeted with specific knowledge and specific target. You know, guerrilla warfare is warfare conducted among a population. And the art of guerrilla warfare, and the United States has never quite mastered this art, but the art is to get rid of the people who are fighting you without unnecessarily harming the civilians that the enemy is hiding amongst. Airstrikes that are not tightly controlled, that are not, you know, very, very pinpointed, directed against the enemy, and have no chance of reaching out against the civilian population, that can be effective in some circumstances. But random airstrikes or airstrikes that are conducted in an undisciplined manner are likely to be counterproductive in a guerrilla warfare.
Do you detect any relationship between the insurgency and ISIS?
That's a good question. I think the insurgency would exist if there were no ISIS in the world. I think the insurgency reflects a breakdown in fundamental relations between a portion of the people in the Sinai and the Egyptian government. That's where the insurgency comes from. But the existence of ISIS allows the insurgency to claim a more respected brand, if you will, and gain adherence, and possibly, although I haven't seen any evidence of it, gain expertise from returning Egyptian fighters or weapons, but I haven't seen any indication of that yet, but it's possible that that brings it to it as well. It seems, though, that most of the violence conducted in at least the last month has been improvised explosive devices. So these are home-manufactured weapons. They don't require a whole lot of outside assistance. And if the problem of alienated people in the Sinai were adequately addressed by the Egyptian government, ISIS wouldn't be a consideration.
With a socioeconomic aspect of the Sinai insurgency, should the Egyptian government rethink its tactics and strategies?
I think so, yeah. The Sinai is key to Egypt's tourism industry. The bomb that brought down the Russian plane could not have been planted without at least some tacit support or a willingness to step aside by people who should have known better in the Sinai. So the violence there indicates that the Egyptian tactics, which are rather heavy-handed, are not achieving their end, and they probably won't achieve their aim. I think a strategy that focuses more on engaging the population, addressing their needs, and then separating the malcontents, the violent malcontents, from the general population is likely to be more effective in the long run.
Professor David DeRoche is with the Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Zimbabwe and Zambia have given a French engineering firm a nearly $295 million contract to repair the Kariba hydroelectric dam. The dam is managed by the Zambezi River Authority on behalf of the two countries. Reuters reports Kariba's wall is swelling, raising the risk of cracks in the structure. The dam could hold back up to 180 billion cubic meters of water, although drought in the region has kept water levels much lower. The Kariba Dam was built in the 1950s. A 2015 report said that if it were to collapse, it would threaten about 3.5 million people in Zimbabwe and Zambia. Repair work will include fixing the plunge pool at the base of the dam, as well as the spillway, which is used to control the flow of water from the dam. Work would take up to 5 years to complete and will be funded through a combination of grants and loans.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our news producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.